Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. We're speaking with Alberto Fernandez first. Protests continue across Iran. They've been largely smothered by this point today, thanks to the regime cracking down on internet access in the country. And that's not necessarily a good thing, mind you. In fact, it's troubling. During the protests, at least 34 mosques have been set on fire in Tehran. Why is this happening in a country that has a reported 98% population of Muslims? The answer is complicated, and we can posit some ideas, but there is a demographic complication to the answer, and we'll speak with Ambassador Alberto Fernandez about this. After that, I would like to address a particular issue pertaining to what's been going on in the public sphere. This has to do with Rene Good and ICE and the whole uproar that we've seen. I want to highlight how necessary it is for you and I to respond to that issue from a Catholic perspective. Now, what that effectively means is guarding ourselves from ridiculous outrage. Now, I'm going to be clear, for the most part, most of my Christian friends have responded to this with the rightful posture, the posture of the gospel, which is we do mourn the fact that a woman died and therefore a child is without their mother. But at the same time, there are also complicated factors in the situation that we can consider, chief among which is this is a law enforcement officer and there are rightful requests that they can make. This was a difficult situation and therefore, he is also owed our prayers. Rather than a demonization and a villainization on both parts, the Catholic virtuous mean here is to stave the impulse of overt reaction, knee-jerk reactions. Now more than ever, the Church needs this of us. Society needs this of us. And then finally, we speak with my friend Dr. Henry Russell. On this day in 1535, Henry VIII officially declared himself head of the Church in England. The English Reformation was devastating to both English reason but also English art. Dr. Henry Russell joins us to talk about why this is. All this after the headlines.
Thank you, Marcus, and good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Thursday, January 15th. It's the Feast of St. Maurice. And today's news is brought to you by Visiting Angels, providing loving care and assistance for seniors in need at visitingangels.com. The UN Security Council is meeting today to discuss the crisis unfolding in Iran. Multiple news reports say a briefing on the situation was requested by the United States. The meeting comes as over 3,000 protesters have reportedly died in Iran as authorities crack down on anti-government demonstrations. President Trump's meeting with Venezuelan opposition leader Maria Corina Machado is done. Machado said the meeting was great as she departed the White House this afternoon. She did not say if she had gifted her 2025 Nobel Peace Prize to Trump as she had said she wanted to. Trump's relationship with Machado has been somewhat complicated since the U.S. arrested former Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro. Following that military operation, Trump said Machado doesn't have the support within or respect within the country. One of the last surviving Tuskegee Airmen is celebrating his birthday. Brigadier General Enoch Woody Woodhouse was part of a U.S. fighter group who were trained at Tuskegee Army Airfield in Alabama and became the first black aviators to serve during World War II. On Wednesday, Woodhouse celebrated his 99th birthday. And the U.S. continues to see a vinyl revival. Entertainment data tracker Luminate reports vinyl album sales jumped for the 19th consecutive year in 2025. Vinyl sales grew by 8.6%, while digital album sales fell by nearly 16%. From the AveMariaRadio.net News Desk, I'm Dan McGraw.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Protests continue across Iran, though they've been largely smothered today because the regime has cracked down on internet access in the country. During the protests, at least 34 mosques have been set on fire in Tehran. Why is this happening in a country where a reported 98% of the population is Muslim? The answer is complicated. Ambassador Alberto Fernandez joins us. He's Vice President of the Middle East Media Research Institute and a contributor to EWTN News and National Catholic Register. Alberto, thank you for joining us, and it's good to speak with you again.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on with you.
In the last time that we had you on, we had discussed the circumstances of what's going on. For those who are just joining us, can you recap the scope and scale of the protests as we know it right now?
Well, the protests started in late December as a result of a series of things of real anger about inflation, food prices, corruption, political repression. And they've grown and grown, but as you said, they've been repressed with unspeakable violence. And it seems like it's the repression has been the bloodiest massacre that has occurred in modern Iranian history, several thousand killed.
The present regime responded very quickly. You mentioned the last time between the capturing of protesters, attempting to politically silence everyone, potential public executions, but also jamming phone signals and internet.
Yes, that's right. I mean, they've, I think they're in the eighth day or seventh day of blocking the internet. You know, the images come in dribs and drabs, but, you know, once the internet is turned back on, unfortunately, probably after the protests have been smothered, I'm sure we're going to be deluged with graphic images of the killed and of violence and of, you know, large numbers of corpses and bodies, unfortunately.
Because of the lack of consistent information, it would appear that the casualty toll is anywhere between 2,000 and 12,000. And like you mentioned, this is turning out to be one of the bloodiest incidents in modern Iranian history.
Yes, I mean, there's no doubt about that. It's very ironic to compare, for example, to the 1978-1979 Iranian Revolution, when the worst day of that revolution against the Shah, troops fired on demonstrators and killed, I think, 64 people. Here we've had the number, as you noted, at least several thousand, and it could be over 10,000.
One of the things that you've highlighted in this piece in National Catholic Register, which might surprise a lot of people, is at least 34 mosques have been set on fire in Tehran, the capital of Iran. And there were images showing an opposition is throwing Molotov cocktails inside mosques in Isfahan. Mm-hmm. So it's clear that these protests have taken on these religious institutions. What's going on?
Well, the simplest explanation, it's complicated, but the simplest explanation is a very obvious one. This is a regime that's wrapped itself in religion. Mm-hmm. It is its justification for everything it does. And not just religion in general, but obviously Twelver Shia Islam, and specifically what is known as Wilayat al-Faqih, the rule of the jurisprudent, meaning the rule of the cleric. Mm-hmm. So religion has been tainted. Islam has been tainted, the official Islam of the regime, with everything the regime has done. The lack of services, the corruption, the hypocrisy of the regime, the murder of innocents, all of it comes wrapped in the packaging of political Islam, which has been in power for almost 50 years. So it's getting the blame for the justification, religious justification that the regime gives for everything it does.
Could it be the case that there are provocateurs from the regime itself that are setting the mosques on fire to further propagate their cause for arresting protesters?
Well, I mentioned that point, and that can't be discounted. Mm-hmm. However, what's happened is, the things that have been targeted are as things which are seen as symbols of the regime. Mm-hmm. So, government banks have been targeted. There's a lot of bank-related corruption in Iran. Police stations have been targeted, and mosques have been targeted as well, especially in Tehran. So that leads one to believe that the connection, that's the regime connection, which is driving this.
Mm-hmm. And you also highlight a third potential, which tends to come up during public protests. And in the words of the philosopher Alfred Pennyworth, some men, Master Wayne, just want to watch the world burn.
Indeed. I mentioned that because there is in every type of mass movement, even ones that are just, even ones that are for a good cause, revolutions attract good people, attract visionaries. They also attract psychopaths as well. They also attract criminals as well. And even though the cause of the Iranian demonstrators is just, it's not outside the realm of possibility that there are also bad elements involved as well.
Tell us about the Basij, who they are, and how they've been deployed. What are they doing now?
Well, the elements repressing the demonstration are made up, obviously, of police
mm-hmm.
and of the so-called Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps and the Basij. The Basij are basically a fanatical volunteer militia created by Khomeini in 1979, used as kind of cannon fodder during the Iran-Iraq War, the 1980-1989 Iran-Iraq War. And, they're basically young men, often uneducated, who've been brainwashed and have been given a gun and said, go kill to defend the revolution. So obviously they're particularly hated. And there's a connection between some mosques and these gunmen who are, certain mosques that are used as training sites and recruitment sites for this paramilitary organization.
And this paramilitary organization tends to target young men, even boys, precisely because they're so easily ideologically brainwashed. And so this is forming a greater picture of what's going on the ground in Iran right now.
Yes, obviously, from all accounts, the true believers are a minority in Iran today. The true believers in the revolution. Mm-hmm. But as we've seen in many cases of dictatorships and ideological regimes worldwide, all you need is a violent, empowered, true believing minority to be able to keep everyone in line and to keep repressing the population so the regime stays in power. And that's what you have in Iran.
Alberto, you also quote a 2020 study about what the potential demographic of Iran might actually look like in terms of the practice of Islam. Can you share with us what that is, but also why that's significant?
Well, this was a fascinating study that was done in late 2020 by two academics at Dutch universities, two Middle Eastern academics and people from Middle Eastern origin. I think one of them of Iranian origin. That basically polled a large number of Iranians, professional study, and basically asked what is their religious identity. And what it found, which was quite a surprise, is that Iranians who truly identify as Shia Muslims are only about a third of the population, and that the percentage that identify themselves as Muslims, there's a small Sunni population in Iran is less than 40%. So more than half the population identifies themselves as something else, as atheists or as nuns, N-O-N-E-S, or Zoroastrians or
We're going to have to stop there, Alberto. Thank you so much. I've been talking with Alberto Fernandez about the situation in Iran.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
You like pizza? Me too. And for that, we can thank our friend, Tom Monahan. First, he starts with $900 and opens one pizza shop. Then it's worldwide, thousands of shops. But all this was just a warm-up for his greatest achievement yet. He built a university.
God inspired Tom to build up generations of men and women who have a hunger to reach the world for Christ. This place is Ave Maria University.
Visit avemaria.edu to see what's next.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Do you feel as though life is flying past you? Are you desperate for a way to find moments of peace and quiet? Lord, Teach Me to Pray, the free Ignatian Prayer Series, will open your heart to His voice, to the peace you are seeking and the only love that fulfills the human heart, Jesus. God is calling you to true joy, knowing Jesus personally. Lord, Teach Me to Pray is free. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com, click on the red box, order the Lord, Teach Me to Pray series now. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Last week, we had the fatal shooting of 37-year-old Renee Good by an ICE agent in Minneapolis. Without surprise, this has ignited a predictable firestorm of tribal reactions, political posturing, social media fury. But I want to caution us. That's the purpose of this commentary. Because within hours, social media hardened into tribal camps. And many political leaders started issuing statements, looking for applause, looking for validation. And yes, this pattern just comes across as tremendously predictable at this point. It's almost ritualized. And therein lies my deeper concern that Catholics ought to be more concerned about the fact that another human life was ended and another family entered grief. And on the other side, there is now a person who strove to perform his job to the best of his abilities, who's now under the social microscope. And all of this warrants true, sober moral reflection. I mean, we're Christians. We're living amid this polarization. And whenever events like this come up, they raise a question, which is, how do we respond with virtue, with wisdom, with fidelity to Christ? Because outrage feels easier, and tribalism is always rewarded. The answer to that is very simple. It's Christian virtue. The answer requires discipline of mind and heart, especially in the face of a surrounding culture that's training us to instant judgment constantly, rather than patient, prayerful discernment. According to the Department of Homeland Security, Renee Good attempted to flee federal agents during an enforcement action, and she struck Officer Jonathan Ross with her vehicle. And to date, we know that it has caused internal bleeding in his torso. In response to what is perceivably a lethal threat, the agent discharged his weapon. Anyone who's ever dealt or faced with law enforcement before, or who have family members in law enforcement, would understand that a certain proportionate use of force in these situations is warranted and needs to be discerned carefully. It needs to be astutely calculated.
The enforcement actions undertaken by ICE right now represent the execution of laws passed through legitimate democratic process. And I know that sounds unpopular. I don't care about being popular. This is the truth. Reasonable people may debate about immigration policy. You can even advocate for reform and write to your representatives. Work through proper channels. Change laws that you consider unjust. But the Christians and the Christian tradition allows for the space of that engagement. But what the Christian tradition of virtue prohibits, though, is the reflexive vilification of law enforcement officers when all they're doing is performing their lawful duty, or in fact, the celebration of those who resist lawful authority, sometimes through dangerous means like this. And that's why the officer involved in this accident, Jonathan Ross, as I mentioned, has suffered serious injuries while performing his job. Remember this, he too has a family, a life, a vocation. And his vocation places him in harm's way daily for the sake of our public order. So yes, Christian charity demands that we extend compassion to him as readily as we extend it to Rene Good. And the tribal impulse to canonize one party and demonize the other, that's a failure of moral imagination, my friends. That's a departure from the gospel's call of actual love. Now, I say all these words as a black immigrant to this nation, as a black man, as an immigrant to this nation. My entire life, I've understood. And by the way, I'm 6'3", and I have a slightly large stature. My entire life, I've understood a simple truth that has served me well in every encounter with law enforcement, which is this: obedience to lawful authority and courteous, respectful conduct dramatically reduces the likelihood of escalated confrontations. I learned this wisdom early on. I observed this from the minority culture that I was raised in. I learned very early that regardless of any injustices that might exist in law enforcement systems, my personal conduct remains well within my control, and it is my moral responsibility. I also learned how nonsensical retaliation to law enforcement is quickly escalated into tragic consequences. I want to be clear here. Has every encounter I've had with law enforcement been pleasant? Well, not everyone, no. Have I witnessed or experienced moments where officers acted with less than perfect professionalism? Certainly. I've lost count in the 8 years I've lived in the United States how many times I've been tested for explosives residue at airports. But the overwhelming majority of my interactions with police, immigration officials, and other authorities have proceeded without incident, precisely because I approach them with respect, with compliance, and with courtesy. This pattern holds true across countless communities and millions of daily interactions between citizens and law enforcement. And none of these will make the headlines because there's no drama. There's a virtue here of respectful obedience to lawful authority, and that deserves urgent rehabilitation in our culture. Parents, we have to teach our children from the earliest ages how to interact safely and appropriately with law enforcement officers and other officials. That's an act of love, truly. It's a practical protection against tragedy. It's a formation in civic virtue. And that civic virtue will actually strengthen the entire social fabric. Because the alternative can sometimes put, especially young people, in genuine danger. Our Christian doctrine acknowledges that human institutions remain marked by sin. This is not an argument for institutional or systemic racism. It is an argument for the fallenness of human nature. Because of this being marked by sin, abuses of authority can sometimes occur. The church has never taught us to be blindly obedient to every command of every official. Unjust laws may, under certain carefully defined circumstances, be legitimately resisted. But if the law is by itself objectively just, then Christians must remain submissive to the law to a reasonable degree and also vigilant against genuine tyranny. This is not a blank check for lawlessness, no matter how infuriated we get in the cause of justice. The vast majority of law enforcement officers in this country perform their duties honorably, often at great personal risk and sacrifice. And they deserve the presumption of good faith that we would extend to practitioners of any other profession. When specific officers commit specific wrongs, appropriate accountability mechanisms exist, and those failures tend to get addressed quite often. The answer to occasional abuse, then, is reform and accountability, not wholesale rejection of law enforcement and its legitimacy. But my invitation to all of us right now is holiness. Outrage feels satisfying in the moment. It might even present a sense of righteousness, tribal belonging, moral clarity, but outrage will eat you alive, and it'll eat society alive. I want to make this very clear. Renee Good's death deserves mourning because a human person is now dead, and her son's loss deserves our prayers. But the injured officer also deserves our concern and gratitude and prayers. The complex questions surrounding immigration policy, let's be thoughtful about it. Let's have good faith debates about them. But none of these realities warrant the reduction of a human tragedy to tribal ammunition or the abandonment of our Christian virtue for the cheap satisfaction of political outrage. It's not worth it. Christ demands that we be better, and we must be better. No, there is a pathway forward, my friends, and that is to speak the love of Christ constantly, to pursue justice through legitimate means, and to teach our children the virtues that preserve their safety and their integrity, and to respect and honor just law enforcement, and to resist the temptation to either canonize or demonize based on political ideological allegiance. Let's be Christians worthy of the name Christian in the public sphere. Stay tuned, I'm Marcus Peter.
Resetting your password, unsubscribing from emails, printing anything. Why are simple things sometimes so complicated? Thankfully, with an auto owner's insurance independent agent, getting the right coverage for your business doesn't have to be one of them, so you can get back to more important things, like learning how that printer works. That's simple human sense.
Call Choice Insurance Agency at 734-641-4200.
Welcome to an Advanced Dentistry Center family. This is Dr. Metti, and our team strives to treat you like family in a loving and compassionate way as we focus on serving you in a Christ-like manner. We do this by emphasizing prevention and general well-being for a lifetime. Our private practice is small, personal, state-of-the-art, and innovative, with the goal to educate and motivate our patients in improving their oral health. It is through a partnership with you that you will achieve the goals for your smile. Advanced Dentistry is serious about the level of care we provide, with attention to details and an exceptional level of care, skill, and judgment. We are thrilled for the opportunity to serve you.
Dr. Matthew and the team invite you to visit them at AdvancedDentistryCenter.com or call them at 248-594-9592. That's 248-594-9592. AdvancedDentistryCenter.com.
St. Therese of Lisieux, the cloistered Carmelite nun, and St. Joan of Arc, the 17-year-old girl who led the French army and was burned at the stake. Two paths to holiness that awaken the contemplative heart and the warrior spirit. The Therese and Joan Women's Retreat is the first weekend of Lent, February 20th to the 22nd at the St. Francis Retreat Center in DeWitt, featuring Sean Breeden and Elizabeth Jingle. Click the banner at AveMariaRadio.net to register by Friday, January 30th.
2026 promises to be a great year for travel, to explore the Bible and our Catholic heritage. Steve and Janet Ray here. We're scheduling our favorite pilgrimage sites just for you to enrich your faith. Ireland, Lourdes and Fatima, our St. Paul Mediterranean cruise. As always, we have the best Catholic guides, hotels, and restaurants in our famous time-tested Footprints of God pilgrimages.
Find the Ave Maria Radio travel tab at AveMariaRadio.net.
Hi, I'm Matthew Handley from PurpleCatholic.com, inviting you to my new program, Death Comes for the Archbishop. Each week, we'll explore Willa Cather's timeless novel of faith and frontier life in 19th century New Mexico. You'll hear vivid narration and thoughtful conversations with historians and theologians who bring its spiritual depth to life. Death Comes for the Archbishop, Saturdays at noon on Ave Maria Radio.
The Wine Palace in Livonia is a proud sponsor of Ave Maria Radio. The Wine Palace is a family-owned business for over 60 years where customers come in for a great service. The 9,000-square-foot store includes a humidor, specialty wine room, and a rare and collectible spirits room. We have the largest selection of spirits in the state at the most competitive prices. Ask for one of the brothers, Cliff or Kelly, and thank them for their strong support of Catholic Radio. Delivery is available. Please visit the Wine Palace at I-96 in Middlebelt or at winepalacemi.com.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. On this day in 1535, Henry VIII officially declared himself head of the Church of England. The English Reformation was devastating for a lot of reasons, historically primarily, but many people discount the effect on English reason and English art. We talk about this with Dr. Henry Russell. Dr. Henry Russell is headmaster of the St. Augustine's Homeschool Enrichment Program, which he founded with his bride, Crystal. The program began in 2005 with 20 students and has expanded to well over 103 locations. He's also published and spoken on a myriad of topics pertaining to literature, culture, and Western civilization. Dr. Russell, such a joy to have you with us. How are you?
I could say it's always a joy to see you and to speak with you. But, you know, I was rather hoping I would get through this day without being reminded of what a horrible anniversary it is from 1535. But instead, you know, my friend Dr. Peter says, well, let's really think about the fact that Henry VIII, ripped England out of the body of Christ on this day.
Okay, that is it. First off, I apologize. But having been brought, I shared this with you. I was brought up in a British empiricist paradigm of history.
Right.
And it was a very strictly English version until I became Catholic and realized that the Catholic underpinnings of England far transcend the history that I learned. And I felt betrayed. But that's one part, but what you said is so accurate. Henry stuck his hand into the heart of England and ripped out its Catholic heart.
And in a sense, you know, I don't want to defend him, but I think he barely meant it. Mm. In other words, Henry wanted to have his way. That's Henry VIII for you. And he was a man of enormous energy and enormous talent. But he was dead set that he would have the marriages and that he needed in order to produce a male heir, which, of course, never worked out properly. The one he did produce died by the age of 16. But, you know, once Henry had made himself pope, He actually made sure that most of the sacraments that were being exercised within this new kind of pretend church of which he was the head they looked almost exactly like Catholic sacraments. Mm. You know, his was not an ideological hatred of the church. It really wasn't a hatred of her doctrines. It was almost purely this desire that you see in so many historical figures to not have anyone over them, to not be answerable to the Pope.
Now, we do want to highlight that there was a point where he willingly did submit to Rome, even writing in defense of the sacraments against Luther.
That's right, although we think that Thomas More probably wrote most of that, but he did receive the title of Defensor Fidei for that wonderful book. So, in some ways, it's just just a mush and a mess, you know. He's not like a Luther who is cold-hearted and calculating. What he did was almost, you know, the work of a man who just couldn't control his emotions and his desires. Anyway, be that as it may, you know, your question, your pursuit of the idea of how it affects literature is fascinating, because other than Shakespeare's Henry VIII, which was written quite a long time later, and indeed Shakespeare had to be kind of dragged out of his retirement, and he had to be teamed up with a far lesser playwright to do it at all.
And he had to be very careful about how he wrote it, too.
Exactly. And the play itself is notable because a great deal of it reads like a critique of Henry and his, you know, machinations with various figures. There are a couple of soaringly beautiful Shakespearean passages that seem to praise him, but they do seem out of place in certain ways. You know, I sort of put that play up against the play with Joan of Arc. You know, it's so divided in its concept. But, you know, a lot of the praise of Henry was clearly written by the I'm forgetting the name of his the person who is credited with a great deal of the work, and you know, you don't see that in Shakespeare. Shakespeare is not all that fond of Henry, but perhaps, you know, as he was aging and moving toward death, perhaps his sense of Henry versus the horror of Elizabeth, and the, you know, the folly and the treachery of boy, today I'm just blanking. Her successor from Scotland. You know, it may have made Henry look good, just in the sense that he really wasn't trying to tear the church apart, and Elizabeth was.
And in fact, Elizabeth was very, very targeted about that.
Right.
But suffice to say that Henry's actions, just like Luther's, were so damaging. Luther was a lot more vitriolic in it, but was so damaging that even he couldn't have foresaw
the eventual
fallout and epistemological issues that were happening in England.
And they happened subtly and somewhat slowly. I mean, you know, the great break in terms of reason waits to some degree until 1651, you know, with the publication of Leviathan by Thomas Hobbes. And, you know, by that time, a groundswell of opinion is there for him to shape and to radicalize even more. But when Henry pulls England out of the church, he is pulling the logic of his own kingship out from under himself, because that logic is deeply connected with the sacrament. We don't talk about coronation as a sacrament, but in effect, that's what it is. It involves the laying on of hands. It involves the enchrisming. It involves the declaration that this this man is king by the will of God, as communicated through the rightful members of the church, and that his kingship is based on the Davidic kingship and the kingship of Saul, where this is a religious gift that no one else, you know, is given, and for which he had been prepared. You know, well, if you become Pope, unfortunately, there's no one to do that for you. You no longer are in connection with that. And fairly quickly, although I don't think Henry saw it, I think somebody like Cromwell might have seen it, that the idea of coronation becomes more of a civic act with religious dressing, at which point, you know, since it's civic, it's controlled by those who control the body politic. And it can be given or taken away.
Yeah. And that's exactly the fallout that we begin to see, because it ceases to be this lowercase s sacrament,
right,
and a participation in a divine vocation and into a power that man establishes for himself. My guest is Dr. Henry Russell. He is the headmaster of St. Augustine's Homeschool Enrichment Program, and he's a wealth of wisdom pertaining to, in this case, the historicity of literature and its development. And we're talking about the Henry VIII declaring himself supreme head of the Church of England. Stay tuned, I'm Marcus Peter.
Today's programming is brought to you in part by a gift from our day sponsor, Michael Rozeffa and Marie Schleppers. Thank you so much for your donation to help build the church and bless the nations.
Now you can support Ave Maria Radio by becoming a day sponsor too. Send anyone a message, a friend, a family member, or a priest, just someone close by. Call 877-288-1077 and tell them you want to be a day sponsor.
Is your child struggling with math or reading? Want to boost their grades and confidence? Hi, this is Ed Bahura. Welcome to Sylvan Learning Centers, where success is just a session away. With 45 years of experience, Sylvan Learning offers help in reading, math, college prep, and much more, with flexible schedules, affordable rates, and interest-free financing. Enroll today and watch your child's confidence soar. Catch up, keep up, and get ahead. Call 1-800-EDUCATE.
Most physicists agree that the cosmic tape can be rewound to a moment 13.8 billion years ago, when there was a small point, like Horton's dust speck, which gradually expanded into our universe. As to where the speck came from, how it happened to be, the same cosmologists are clueless. 3.8 billion years ago, they estimate, life first appeared on Earth. To this day, its origins are still unknown. About 40,000 years ago, the record of human history suddenly changed. Art, advanced language, trade, travel, suddenly all became part of the anthropological record. The source for this sudden change? Unknown. Our lives, our history, are shrouded in mystery. Yet foolishly, we think that we control, that we can decide who has value and what characteristics establish human worth. Much better would it be if we were to live in open-mouthed wonder, and to see all as gift. GuadalupeWorkers.org.
What makes an act moral or immoral? The Catechism of the Catholic Church lays out specific criteria for us to follow. When he acts deliberately, man is, so to speak, the father of his acts. Acts freely chosen can be morally evaluated as either good or evil. The sources on which the morality of an act are determined are three. 1, the object chosen. 2, the intent of the act. 3, the circumstances surrounding the act. To be moral, the object of the act itself must be good and the intention pure. The circumstances are secondary to the first two criteria. They can increase or diminish the morality of the act. For instance, stealing a candy bar is wrong, but far less evil than robbing a bank. Intent and circumstance, however, cannot change the moral quality of the act itself. The end does not justify the means. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Support for this Ave Maria radio program comes in part by the non-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Are you shopping for mortgage products, Catholic investing, Catholic health, real estate, or estate planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for these needs. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. More information at stanthonyservices.org or 877-LIFE-US1.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is.
Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Pete. I'm talking with Dr. Henry Russell, and we're talking about the English Reformation and how it broke reason. So, Dr. Russell, I want to go back to the fallout of Henry VIII's actions. The monarchy, especially by the height of Christendom, was viewed as liturgical empire. And you can't have liturgical empire without union with the high priest and the one true church. Right. You sever that, you take liturgy away, all you have is secular empire.
Right.
What does that do to the way people think about truth, about authority?
The more they do think about it, the more they live with it, they become more relativistic in their thoughts. It's an easier task to rebel, to become not an Anglican, but a Puritan.
Mm.
Not either one of those, but a Methodist. You have no principle of unity. You've sundered it. You've tried to put it into the king. That was his goal, that to make himself the principle of unity, both politically and religiously. It didn't work religiously. No one really bought it.
Mm.
You know, and it's part of what I was trying to say about Shakespeare being one of the very few who wrote any literature about Henry, and he was basically told to, as far as we can tell.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those fascinating things that everybody's looking at Henry and saying, well, you know, you may be a very dynamic king, and you may have, you know, sort of built the navy. You may have led us in wars against France and the Holy Roman Emperor and against Ireland, against Scotland. But you're nobody's idea of a pope.
Mm-hmm.
You really aren't a religious figure at all. And, you know, you go on to Elizabeth, and neither is she. Now, you know, they try to make up for this by emphasizing the role of the Archbishop of Canterbury. But the law is quite clear. The Anglican Church is the church by law established, and its head is the king or the queen. So essentially the structure began to fall apart. Oh, by the way, I never like to say anything that sounds like a correction of you, but I never use the word reformation.
Yes, revolt.
It's just a revolt.
Yes. Completely agree.
That's all it is. The Reformation occurs in Italy with the, with the Council of Trent and its many distinctions.
Well, I completely agree. And that leads us back to a comment you made earlier. And I can imagine some of our listeners were wondering what you meant by that, which is that under a proper ordering of monarchy,
yes,
there really is a sacramentality to those who undertake office. We actually get a concept of that here in the United States. The swearing of an oath into office has a sacramental character. It's a covenantal act.
Right.
Just flesh that out for us, please.
It's very odd, isn't it? It's as if we have continued an act that we have argued has no particular meaning.
Mm.
You put your hand on the Bible. You are swearing to God. Now, at that point, your oath is almost simply a personal act between, say, you know, the president and God.
Mm-hmm.
It really doesn't have any particular underpinning in political reality.
Mm.
You know, it you say you're going to do it, and that's all very good. It's not just swearing into office. I mean, if you go into the military, for goodness sakes, you take an oath to the country. And yet somehow we're supposed to, not believe that we have a national relation to God. We have almost dissolved that relationship. And yet we insist on this this relic of it. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm glad we insist on it.
Mm-hmm.
It may point to a bad conscience that will help us to realize that there's a very deep relationship between political identity and God, religious identity at its most fundamental.
Now, because of that, this breaking that Henry VIII does with Rome forces him to, like you mentioned, bifurcate the concept of a liturgical empire, because no one looks at him and thinks that's a religious exemplar.
No.
So they elevate the Archbishop of Canterbury, and now you've got this separation that happened with the Aaronic priesthood almost. You know, the Archbishop of Canterbury is liturgical figurehead, but Moses and the king are the pseudo-king, the political figurehead. And in reality, all he's done is he's dissolved what would otherwise have been the true unifying reality of England and the world.
Right. Because he insists that he is the religious head, even as the Archbishop of Canterbury has to be functioning as the religious head, or else the system, becomes a kind of joke. And of course it did, and of course the king was beheaded by 1648, not Henry, but not it's not a long stretch from 1535 to 1648. So when I say he undermined the whole conception of kingship, I'm quite serious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you look at the whole of Shakespeare's work, he's haunted by the problem of what you do with a king who has rebelled against God, because he is nevertheless God's vicar in a very real sense. Mm-hmm. I know I'm using a term that should be applied to the Pope on earth. And if you reach out to harm him, you risk rebelling not against a political power, but against a divine power. And this was so serious for Shakespeare that he revisits the question play after play after play.
Mm-hmm.
But, by just about 30, 40 years after his death, the Puritans are not in the least held back by this conception.
Mm-hmm.
And they are ready to cut off the head of the king, and they do so. So in essence, Henry destroys the rationality.
Mm-hmm.
Of kingship, and it takes a while for that to catch up. Now, if I might, and stop me if you want, but it within about another 100 years, another effect of the destruction of the synthesis of religion, reason, and political power takes place, and that is, there really is only one philosophy in Europe, and that's the philosophy of Thomas Aquinas, which has taken up into itself everything else that's worth taking up.
Mm-hmm.
But Protestantism will not be able to live with Aquinas.
Mm-hmm.
Henry and Elizabeth and others will, if Aquinas maintains his dominion, they're all going to have to go back to the Catholic faith.
Mm.
And just admit they were wrong. So Protestantism will be seeking its own philosophy, something to give it at least a sense of intellectual and political legitimacy.
Mm-hmm.
And that will unfortunately be the materialism.
Mm.
Of Locke and Hobbes. Protestantism will make a devil's bargain with these, because they are a rebellion against the church. They, you know, they mean to get rid of any idea of the Holy Spirit having fitted persons to be either leaders of the religious order or of the political order. And as such, you know, it's kind of like the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what the Protestants want to do. And so, you know, I mean, some of the greatest of the intellectual followers of Hobbes and Locke were the Puritans.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the long run, we don't have time for that today, but the contradictions lead to the destruction of the great Protestant denominations.
Yeah, as we're seeing today, even the complete destruction of it in the public sphere. And therefore, when we're looking at this event, we need to understand that ruptures like this don't just happen in a vacuum.
No.
And they don't stop at the act itself.
Well, that's it. You know, I think Henry thought it could stop.
Mm.
Right? Just let me be Pope. I won't do much. I'm not going to make many changes. I'm just going to especially make sure we have divorce so that I can get what I want. And then we'll be okay. I'll be done with it. You know, it's like most of us. You know, can't I just have this one sin? You know, can't I just do this and everything else, you know, I'll be obedient in and I'll be pretty good. And I think he would have been, I believe he would have been horrified
to see
where it goes within 100 years.
And definitely what has happened to England today as a result of his actions.
Yes.
My guest has been Dr. Henry Russell, headmaster of the St. Augustine's Homeschool Enrichment Program. And we've been talking about the lead-up, but also the fallout to Henry VIII declaring himself supreme head of the Church of England, severing himself from Rome, and all the effects thereof. Thank you for joining us. I'm Marcus Peter.